Question number 20. Which city has the most attractive girls? Montreal. I don't even have to explain this one. Hey friends, this is Podcast Ruined by Software Engineer. On this episode, I get to talk... It's freaking episode 50. What am I talking about? I'm talking to myself, if anything. Doing another AMA, another Ask Me Anything. To the people who have been listening since episode 1, thank you. For the people who just drop in here and there, and if this is the first episode you listen to, thank you as well. You could do so many different things in life and you decide to listen to this. So that's the biggest gratitude I could share with y'all and appreciate the time you've spent listening to this. Anyways, as per tradition, for every 10 episodes, I've done this on episode 10, episode 20, episode 30, episode 40, and now episode 50, so this is the fifth edition of it. I'd like to do a quick Ask Me Anything, just a recap in terms of how the hell did we get here, but also just interact with the people that listen to the show. This is broken down in four different categories, and I'll be numbering them as we go throughout the show. There's 31 questions in total, so I'll be starting the questions every time with the number of the question. And there's four big categories that I'm going into. The first category is programming and work, follow up with Perry's hot takes, then we got life and travel, and then the last section is miscellaneous questions. And if you do have a second, don't forget to hit the follow button on your podcast app so you don't miss out on more of Podcasts Ruined by a Software Engineer. Anyways, let's get into the questions. Our first category of questions is programming and work questions. Question number one, what is your favorite programming language? Currently, Golang and TypeScript. Leaning more towards the Golang side, that's for sure. But to be fair, I think my favorite programming languages or favorite language has changed over the years. And for those of you probably asking, like, why does one even have a favorite programming language to begin with? And why does it change? I think it really depends on what you're trying to build. Very, very high level in tech, at least in software engineering, some languages are better at building certain applications versus other applications. For example, if you want, I guess, like backend servers, then people are not recommended to use JavaScript to build backend servers, and vice versa, in the sense that if you want to build like a UI application where you're able to let users interact on a web browser, for example, by default, a lot of times you would recommend using JavaScript to build that versus some server-side language. In my case, why nowadays I prefer Golang and TypeScript over a lot of any other languages is I've been in this swarm of building a lot of, I guess, like command line applications and scripting and all these kind of like fun API stuff where you just pipe data from one to the other. And I find that fascinating. Of course, I do a lot of front end work also as well. So that's where TypeScript comes in. And I really appreciate, you know, the type system and how you could really catch bugs before it even happens. Question number two, what is your favorite AI? That's a good question. What is my favorite AI? I think even the definition of AI in terms of artificial intelligence, everybody has a different definition. I think mine is fairly different than most people. Standard, you would imagine when people say AI is like, oh, like Alexa is quite intelligent and it's artificial. So that's an example. Or you would have other people thinking about like clothes. You have your llama. You have your, of course, the OpenAI model that they're using. I think my favorite AI today at this second is still probably Google search. There's so many people who probably wouldn't even consider that AI, but if you really understand what is my use case of AI, is really finding answers quickly to something I either don't know, like when's the next flight for this specific flight number, or what is the recipe for XYZ? I think a lot of these like questions, the way I ask questions, at least in my life at the moment, hasn't really changed. Don't get me wrong, there are a lot of search engines that are better than Google search at the moment, but I think in terms of the ability to just ask questions really quickly and to interact with, whether it's a browser or directly on my phone, I think that form of artificial intelligence is getting answer from something that is computed very quickly. That's probably still my favorite form of AI, at least. What a boring answer. Question number three. What does AI mean to you? To me, we all say this thing where our everyday life is integrated with AI. Left and right, there's AI things. You notice some of them, but there's probably a good 90% plus that you do not notice. Kind of like the AI you see day to day is probably just the tip of the iceberg. So I do embrace it. I do embrace the fact that it's absolutely mind-boggling how intelligent this technology is, how hard it is to build this technology. So I think it's something that people see it as a very negative thing sometimes, depending on the media, depending on how it's portrayed. But for me, I definitely see it more in terms of it's a tool, and you gotta work with the trust that whether it's regulations, governments, or any kind of entity or body that can actually control this and write policies about it to actually do it right, it's nearly impossible to tame this beast. But hey, that's what's exciting about it, and we'll just have to see what happens in the future. Question number 4. What do you admire the most about your first boss? My first official boss ever, this was when I was hired at a furniture store. It was a part-time role, and the boss, the individual, like, they were great. I enjoyed just working there in the sense of, like, obviously my responsibility wasn't massive. A lot of it, I worked behind the scenes in the inventory. So basically, it was a lot of boxes and a lot of, like, building furniture and building lamps, but also working on the floor sometimes. If ever there's any help on the floor, I'm also there. I think what I admire the most about my boss back then was mostly in terms of the whole operations. You have to worry about the hardware, you have to worry about the actual, like, supply of it, you have to worry about the opening hours of the shop, you have to worry about the people who you hire, like, even though it's part-time students most of the time, it's like, it's a big deal at the end of the day. And you also got to worry about the corporate side to it, the franchising side. I think it was a franchise back then. There was just so much to worry about. And I think looking back in terms of what did I admire the most about my first boss from back then was how much they did all around. Of course, they were in good moods, bad moods. Everybody kind of does that. But looking back, it just really made me think of how much they were doing. Of course, they also had a family to raise and everything. So just putting out all that together, I think that's really just something to be, you know, using as a positive influence for myself. Question number 5. What is the feeling that describes your most freeing moment after you started your business? For context, I founded a company like a couple years ago. Anybody could do that. At the end of the day, you just got to file a couple of paperwork. And I guess I've been using that as a channel, as a medium to just experiment stuff, to build things, to see what people want, what people don't want, and just use that as an excuse to reach out to other people. I wish I was financially independent because of it, but unfortunately, that is not the case. I still work full-time, and this whole, like, mini-business, mini-company, whatever it is, it's definitely more of a part-time thing. But the feeling of being free and, like, freeing moments and how I would describe it at the end of the day is you really get to just make decisions out of it. You get to build whatever you want and share it to the world, and if it works and people like it, you really are responsible for all of it. And I think that's probably what a lot of people enjoy at the end of the day, is being able to use their two hands to create something, being able to share their opinions and being able to share their ideas and put into motion. That's what I would describe as the freeing moment, the blank canvas that you get to work with, basically. Question number 6. Who would you hire if you had to choose between your younger self, your current self, or your future self, and why? To be completely honest, I would never hire myself. Yeah, I think it depends on what you're hiring for. If you're hiring for experience, hopefully my future self will know more than I know today. So in terms of if your role really depends on experience and strategy and I guess like breadth of knowledge, knowing a bit of everything and being able to plug in, I think the seniority, the future self could help there. I sound so corporate at the moment. But my younger self, I feel like I would qualify that as like, yeah, just throw anything at me. Just give me the goal, the objective, the task, and give me a couple of tools and I should be able to go. Or even without tools, I'll just do regardless. So, a good exercise is just looking back at myself and figuring out, hey, what is my best era? What am I good at today versus my future self or anything? Lots to think about, but amazing question. Question number 7. Where do you see yourself in 5 years? In 5 years, I would like to believe I'm still doing techie stuff, whether it's writing code directly or just working even deeper into like the tech teams and all that. Or I might have completely switched careers and maybe opened a coffee shop or picked up a role in media or gone into teaching. I think that's what's the exciting part, is that never say never. 5 years is a long time to build cool things, and I think every step, every year is always something that I look forward to be like, this year is going to be different than the other year, in the best way possible. Question number 8. What makes you optimistic about the future? What makes me excited for the future is probably how we're going to be doing things so differently in the future. I guess one of the examples is like nowadays, like if we want to book a flight, for example, you could do it, you know, all sitting at home. You could just like open your computer and then just go on a couple websites and probably within like 5-6 clicks, you'll be confirmed on a flight to Hawaii, which is very different than from a decade ago or 2 decades ago, where you either have to physically go into an office or like a travel agency and book it over there, or you do it by phone with a credit card and everything. But imagine in 10 years, it's going to be a different method of doing this. So I think that's where my optimism comes up, is that we're going to find new ways to making our lives slightly easier, slightly more efficient. Obviously, there's going to be a cost to do all of this, but it's possibilities like that that I don't even know what it is today. but hopefully it could be beneficial to a lot of our lives at the end of the day. All right, on to the next category of questions, which is Perry's Hot Takes. Question number 9, what's the future of programming? I think the future of programming is you won't even have to write code in the future. What I mean by that is that nowadays, a lot of programming happens when, you know, a software engineer opens a computer and then he opens a text editor and then they see a bunch of line of codes and then they edit it and then they save it and then they deploy it and then the change happens on a website and then the user gets to interact with a website. In the future, I guess, this layer of having to open the code and edit whichever part to it, I think a lot of that will be abstracted by automation or AI or whatever you want to call it, in a sense of you could probably... There might even be like a voice command thing where it's like, oh, for this feature, we need to add a new button that if you click on it, it will show the user's like most recent receipt. And then once you click on enter, it just generates it and it does the change. And then maybe the next prompt immediately after, you'll be like, oh, can you deploy this change to production, please? Thank you. And then you press enter. And next thing you know, it's deployed and all the users will be using it. It's interesting that I'm saying this is the future of programming. I believe that's already happening at the moment. But I don't think I've seen it at like a reliably crazy large scale, just because the scenario I just described, there's a lot of things that could fail in the process. I think the future of programming is going to be very abstracted. It's going to be very different to what we're doing today. But at the same time, I don't think it's going to happen overnight. So in terms of, is it scary? Yes, it is. But I do think it gives everybody a chance to just slowly integrate it as part of their flow, as opposed to just be like an overnight switch, if anything. A lot of engineers already use these like assistant, these copilot while programming. And to a certain degree, it's in that direction. But that's what I mean by in terms of evolving with the technology is that software engineers out there, at least in terms of programming and coding, it will be a gradual change as opposed to just an overnight replacement. And then watch me be completely wrong. Question number 10. What's next after Cursor.com? So I actually only recently discovered about Cursor.com, and it actually follows up from the previous question that Cursor.com is an example of a tool that lets you generate code. You could write plain English, and then it'll spit out code that you could use directly in your code base. And if you like it, you keep it, and then you deploy it. Cursor.com is one of the examples. The other examples, I believe Sourcegraph does something very, very similar. GitHub Copilot, obviously, it's a very popular choice, integrated into a lot of people's flows nowadays. Perplexity, I believe, also generates a lot of code. So those are all different tools that, not saying they do the exact same thing, but they would help you in your coding. You just start typing, oh, I want to extend this button to also include an alert message if ever this response happens. And then it would generate the code corresponding to your request. In terms of what's next after these tools, what's next after Copilot, what's next after Cursor.com? If we look at it this way, in a sense of nowadays, it's like a coding assistant. Next thing you know, it could honestly just be like an assisting software engineer, so that whether you know or don't know programming, you would just be talking to a artificial software engineer. And then the artificial software engineer will just code everything for you. It's a bit scary, but I keep on saying that, like, this is the fun part about this and the scary part about this. It's a hot take, but I think it's going to happen slowly. Some people might think it happened overnight. Some people might think it won't happen at all. But in this world of efficiency and in this world of trying to make things a lot easier, someone's bound to be looking at this, if not already. Question number 11. AI is so hot right now. How have you been keeping up with its development application in both a personal and professional way? One way I do it is I read a lot of like techie news. Some of you may know Hacker News, but it's a great website for people to really showcase their blog or even something that they're building or even just trending news. There's usually big media articles that pop up here and there. But for me, it gives me a pulse in terms of what is the level of AI that people could use to make something practical. And just because it's like a daily thing, a daily dose, you could kind of see like, oh, the evolution of what kind of stuff people are building today versus, let's say, a month ago or a year ago. It's a very, very fun place to keep up with the technology, especially AI. It's so hot right now that nearly all the articles have some sort of mention to AI in it. Another way, personally, that I try to keep up with it is I do try to use AI tools here and there for the fun of it. What I mean by that is I work on different side projects, and sometimes the small ideas or the thing I'm working on, I ask myself, can it be smarter? Can it be generative? Can you ask it to do things? And one of the examples, I think I was thinking about this the other day, where, you know, news articles sometimes, or if you look at publications, there are certain categories on the finance section or the tech section or whatever it is. The articles, probably you would have one or two new articles a day. I think like if you go to like BBC Sports and you check out the Premier League, some of the articles are maybe like once a day or something like that. And I was like, oh, imagine if you could have like infinitely many articles in a day. So what I mean by trying out new tools is I would try to find like a LLM tool that could generate articles. You got your ChatGPTs, you got your llamas, you got your whatever, your clothes out there. So you just try to use their API and just be like, oh, can you generate me an article about blah, blah, blah. And then if you want to do that scale, then you just try to find a script, or you just try to find an application that could run that process like 1,000 times and see what gives. So for me personally, I just have this like weird curiosity of just trying to see if it's going to work. And if the hot topic right now is AI, then I'll try to use that as an experimental playground for myself. But professionally, and more recently, if anything, is the engineering teams that I actually work on, they promote a lot of using AI tools, internally at least. What is interesting is I think there's a consensus in the industry that we're going into this direction, that everybody will be leveraging it. So internally, they would have like efforts to be like, oh, can you implement this tool that does code review automatically without a human? Obviously, you'll have to like review what it actually reviews, but then it's like, does save a lot of time for humans that spend hours code reviewing, or software engineers that spend hours code reviewing. Other examples is these chatbots that I was talking about, these like smart LLM models. ChatGPT is a very good example, but you could use that as part of your daily workflow. Some people already have internal chat system, whether it's Teams or Slack. You could have bots integrated inside of your Slack to be like, how does this feature specifically work? And then your chatbot, within the scope of your work and all the documents that you have access to, it could actually navigate it and learn and then use that to help you out. On the other front, on the software engineering side professionally, we do have access to these paid tools. Copilot is one of the examples, but there's a lot of the other ones out there to make our lives easier writing code. But yeah, now that I think about it, in a work setting, there's definitely a lot of opportunities and a lot of even like push, a lot of lean, a lot of active effort to introduce more engineers to a new standard, a new way of coding, and a new way of delivering feature, which is very interesting to be part of. Great question. Question number 12. For non-nerdlingers, are there any tools we should engage with or explore so we aren't left in the dust when the robots come for our jobs? Another great question in terms of, I'm pretty sure everybody has asked this to themselves at some point in their lives, where it's like, is my job obsolete? Like, even as software engineers, we ask about that because you see all these tools that actually spit out code, and it's like, wait, that's kind of what software engineers do. We just spit out code at the end of the day. In a layman sense, in the sense of whether you're a teacher, whether you're somebody who works on marketing, whether somebody works in sales, whether somebody who is working at the library, you do have access. For example, the easiest way is go look up ChatGPT. It's kind of like a smart bot. Some people could treat it as Google search. You could just ask it a bunch of questions. And that's a very simple, like, level zero of engaging with an AI model, basically. Secondly, this is actually something I've been thinking about, is for the people who work in, I guess, like corporate, that have these, like, whether Oracle or Salesforce or HubSpot, or if these words mean to you, there's actually a decent opportunity for you to engage with automation. What I mean by that is that there's these very large corporate software. And back in the days before you have, let's say, like the Salesforce CRM system and everything was a bit more manual. And then this Salesforce CRM system made it a little bit easier to keep track of your leads and then your potential sales and blah, 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 blah. If you look at it that way, somebody had to implement this system. But if you think about it, there's a lot of professionals with skills, not exactly writing code, but understanding how to plug one thing to another, whether it's on the marketing side or the sales side or even the operational side, in terms of how you triage bug tickets coming in. And in that case, there'll be a lot of Jira, for example. Jira is a large software that offers a lot of like confluences and different products that you could use to engage. Being able to configure these kind of large software, nowadays, more and more of them offer this like automation or very smart feature. That's kind of how you could interact with it and get better at understanding, oh, wait, this part is generated. Oh, wait, this part is automated. And for me, I kind of classify automation, like smart automation, a little bit into this AI movement. I think those are definitely great opportunities for professionals that are already using system to proactively maybe think about using those and offer yourself, if anybody's asking, to be, oh, I could look into this. I could try to implement it. Even though you don't know how to implement any of it, just because, just like back then, nobody really knows how to implement like a good AI framework or a good AI system until you try doing it. Question number 13. Let's assume the AI firing curve will kick to some degree, larger or less than the domestic rhetoric. let's assume some people would not find a job again in their old tech sectors. How can we fix this non-employment problem? From an individual standpoint, over the decades, back then there was a lot of, I guess, like textile workers who are just like fabricating, you know, clothes by hands, and then nowadays all that is replaced by machines. And then when you have like database configurators that are plugging in like big mainframes of database into each company's system, that kind of has been phased out in the sense of like nowadays data centers are all located in a single warehouse and you don't really need somebody to do it per company on site. I think a lot of it has been shipped to the cloud. You could see that there's always been these shifts, and all these people that I just described, where are they now? My assumption is that they've adapted in the sense of like, instead of manually moving one rack of server to another at a single company, then they might have been recruited directly at the bigger data centers. I think individually, our skills, as we work in corporate or work in any kind of professional environment, we try to keep them as much as possible, and we always want to build on top of it. It's hard to say that if something replaces our job is just gone. I really want to believe that we're in a place nowadays and with technology is that our brain, human brains at least, are capable enough to be flexible and adapt. Even if the role would be completely different, even if one day I'm not physically writing code anymore and I'm just talking to a bot and I'm asking a bot to write code for me. But yeah, it's definitely scary. Don't get me wrong. Like, I think about this. A lot of people think about this. And I think for us, it's trying to be as optimistic as possible. And I think there's always like the more there's AI, there's more of these like more review positions, these more like make sure the AI does well. Same thing as last question. If you want to be ahead of the curve, then get yourself into it. Like offer yourself to implement these systems and these frameworks. I feel like those are definitely the opportunities of embrace the fact that it's going to change and double down on the skills that you really, you know, pride yourself on and you know you're great and that could be adapted and flexible into new roles. On a larger scale, in terms of like policymakers and governments, and when they look at, hey, wait, this company used to hire 1,000 people to do this job, but nowadays for that same job, they hire probably like 100, just because 90% of it can be replaced by a robot arm or something. That is definitely a scary thing in the sense of like, there's people who are probably going to register for unemployment, and that might have another strain on the government in the sense of like, where does this fund go? How do we use this fund? I think we have to look back historically. If I were a government official and I see all these changes, I need to take out all the cases that has happened in the past decades, if not more, century, of when technology has kind of just been increasingly evolving and taking over a lot of the tedious work, and then trying to see what were previous policies and then take those as inspiration. I'm not saying what happened 50 years ago could be the exact same scenario today, but there's already data there that, you know, people have slowly adapted. I think policy-wise, if you need to, as a government, offer incentives or offer tax rebates to not use AI compared to what they have at the moment, those are the kind of different levers and different plugs that I feel like that's one way of looking at it. So, and now moving on to the travel section. Question number 14. What's your favorite place you've been, whether traveling or living there? Living probably still has to be New York City. And traveling, I think that trip that I did in Hungary, Slovakia, and Czech Republic. For context, I've been very, very fortunate in terms of like living in many cool places in New York, London, Hong Kong, Montreal, of course, and travel to many more places. So number one, I really got to freaking appreciate it. So that's that. But also being able to share this. So when people ask questions like this, for me, my definition of why I like living in New York, it's because the city is just so electric. It's just so, it's so polarizing. The highs are highs and the lows are very low at the same time. Whether it's culturally, whether it's politically, whether it's financially. I've kind of described it that, you know, when you wake up, everybody just runs. And whether you run or not, the city is going to go without you. It really just depends on what kind of person you are, what kind of interest, what kind of drive, what kind of reaching out you'll do. And I think living in New York City gives you so much fun and so much opportunity, and it's very, very different than just visiting it for a day or two. So that's why I would answer that for living there. And for traveling, I mentioned that trip there that it's actually multiple countries. I'm sorry, it's not a single traveling destination. But I think one thing I do enjoy is in Europe, at least, there's so much culture in a fairly, I guess, like small distance, if that kind of makes sense. Like, for example, in Texas, you could drive for 6 hours and you're still in Texas. I suppose in Europe, you just take a train for like an hour and a half and you're in a different country with a different background and a different set of like culture and food. So that trip that I was describing, this was at least like 5-6 years ago. So that was Budapest. And then we were in Bratislava and then Prague. I think it's just a combination of the comfort and the value and the food that we were eating and the people we've met. That combination of culture, and I keep on saying eating stuff, that's probably why it really just, you know, is ingrained in my memory. Question number 15. What's the strangest thing you've seen while traveling? I guess the biggest, like, strangest, or you would say culture shock, is I recently went to India this year. I specifically went to Mumbai, Bombay, and the biggest culture shock was the fact that there's always someone ready to help you. Like, you could imagine that fairly common places like hotels and, you know, these hospitality places, there is the expectation to have hospitalities, but then you would also get the same kind of hospitality at non-hotels. And at, like, when you go grocery shopping, there would be somebody there just helping you hold the basket and pick out stuff, and you really don't have to lift a finger. You go to the pharmacy, I remember this, there's probably like 12 people behind the counter. And it's not just about like getting some drugs for you. It's literally, if you want a bag of chips, they'll do it for you as well. They'll just grab it and put it in the bag and get it right for you at the counter. I felt like an alien, if anything. And even at hotels, not just in India, just like anywhere in the world, I'd rather just hold my own bags. At some point, people were telling me it's very insulting to not let people help me. And I was like, whoa, 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 like, what is this rule that I've never heard of? That was definitely an interesting experience that I saw while traveling. Question number 16. Living in Hong Kong versus living in London versus living in New York City. Which one and why? I would still choose today living in New York City, but, you know, as you could say, like year to year, life to life, it could always change. The interesting part is why. I already kind of gave like a preview in terms of it's electric. I feel like that's probably one of the best words to describe it. If you compare the culture, the fact that if you think about the pace, if you think about the density of people within a small area, all three of them has that kind of same pace of doing things and walking fast on the sidewalk. It really is, I guess, like an appeal for me personally, just because I do want to be able to be convenient and take the subway and be there in like half an hour and have a completely different type of food, different type of culture, different type of neighborhoods, and different type of fun activities to do. I still enjoy being a stranger in a city that I kind of live in. I don't want to live life thinking that I've solved everything, that I've seen everything, that I've understood how everything works. And I think all these cities like Hong Kong, New York, London, no matter where I walk, no matter what I've seen, no matter what I do, no matter the people that I've met and will keep on meeting, there's so much more to learn, so much more to see, and so much more to do. So, yeah. Question number 17. Favorite places in New York City? Yeah, favorite places in New York City. If I do this real quickly, I think food places. I've mentioned Becco before, Becco, bottomless pasta for $30. But other spots that I could call out, Wondi Siam around the area, WONDEE SIAM. I think the best Thai food in New York City, along with Thai Diner, like they're pretty much up there. Lucky Cat is a great Japanese izakaya. That's around Midtown. Great, great place. The ambiance, the people, it's really, really fun over there. I think for bars, the ones that kind of come to my mind, a lot of them are like happy hour. I think around Midtown, you would have like Whiskey Trader or like Clinton Hall and like Rudy's. Arthur's Tavern, they do free jazz in the West Village, and I think it's so fun over there, so I think it's probably the best jazz. Ooh, and how could I not mention Flannery's? It's a Tottenham Hotspur bar. It's the Tottenham Hotspur bar of New York, of Manhattan, so if you enjoy football, definitely go check it out over there, unless you're a gooner. Actually, I'll give it an extra nugget. Big, big, big fan of the Met and MoMA. So I think MoMA is first Friday is free, so first Friday of every month should be free. So definitely go there. It's packed. It's crazy. But you will get in, I don't know, within like 20 minutes, 30 minutes, you'll definitely get in. And the Met is free for a resident. It's pay as you wish. And then the extra nugget here is actually the Met has a rooftop that is actually accessible for the people who, you know, who just visits the Met. I don't think a lot of people know this, but I think if you just go to fourth floor, it shoots you right up there. And you're, you know, in the outdoors, you're in Central Park. And then they have like DJs playing up there sometimes. The drinks are like obviously expensive, like $20-25 for a really bad cocktail or like a mixed drink. But I think it's no extra cost. I think it's as long as you get into the Met and it's open, you could just go to the top floor of the Met. One of my favorite places in New York City. Question number 18. What's your thought on Hong Kong culture? Yeah, so for context, both my parents are from Hong Kong. Obviously, loads of relatives, Hong Kongers, and myself, Hong Konger at the end of the day. I've lived there in stints. The best way I could describe it is there's a term, I didn't coin this term, but it's called Hong Kong Jingshan. And the way you would kind of describe that is Hong Kong attitude. It's more on the liveliness side. So Hong Kong liveliness. There's actually no direct translation, but the idea is really just like the spirit of Hong Kong, basically. And the reason why I mention this term is because, like, every Hong Konger relates to it. It's the fighting spirit of Hong Kong people. It's always being the little guy in this big world of conflict. I mean, of course, like, Hong Kong is a very politically charged area. But I think on an individual aspect, a lot of people from Hong Kong, like, there's, of course, disparities. There's, like, the really rich, like, the 1%. For everybody else, it's always been the fighting spirit of, hey, shit happens, but we still gotta live our lives. And that kind of reflects on like the day-to-day. I think like the attitude, the Hong Konger is that they may sound a bit aggressive, kind of like a New York thing. But at the end of the day, like we mean well. Every Hong Konger has always helped somebody else. This Hong Kong culture manifests in like different ways, like the way how, like, for example, some of the food seems very, very simple, but it's extremely delicious. It doesn't matter if you're blue collar, white collar, whatever it is. There's a thing about Hong Kong cuisine that just represents the culture of making things work, even if you don't have everything available to you. And then sometimes you also can express like Hong Kong culture through how you dress. If you ever walk around Hong Kong, you could see the people who just have polo shirts, some like comfortable pants and some sneakers. I think you see a lot of that going around in Hong Kong. So I think it's very hard to pinpoint one thing, which is why this term, this great term of Hong Kong Sing Sun, is great to describe the fighting spirit of everybody from Hong Kong. Question number 19. Where's the next destination for Perry to live at? You know, it's funny. Over the years, I don't think I would consider I actually choose where I live. In a sense of like, I've moved mostly thanks to opportunities. Whether it's a role here, a role there, and it kind of works out, then I just move there. So in terms of choosing, it was more like wherever that had a good role for me, I would go. But in the sense of where's my next destination, I don't know where the next role is. It could be in Singapore, it could be in Tokyo, it could be in Mexico City, it could be anywhere in the world. So I think a lot of those places, where's my next destination? I'd love to dream about that. And if I do make it happen, then I do make it happen. Question number 20. Which city has the most attractive girls? Montreal. I don't even have to explain this one. And on to the last section of miscellaneous questions. Question number 21. Best prank you've been involved in? I don't think I've told this one on this show yet. The context is this was at the office. This was back in the days. And it's fairly common for people to order stuff to the office and then just receive it there and bring it back home at the end of the day. So that's what happened. I just had a couple packages sent to me to my desk at the office. And we had a coworker who would be curious in terms of what is in the box. I guess for the people who know me, I don't really need to open my boxes immediately. I sometimes, out of maybe laziness, I don't know what it is, I just leave it there for a couple of days and then open it after. But in this context, we just found out that somebody was kind of curious in terms of what were in my boxes. And it kind of made me even less inclined to open the boxes. So I kind of ended up leaving the boxes around my desk, and the coworker would see it and it'd be like, oh, when are you going to open those boxes? And I was like, oh yeah, I'll open it when I need it. I know what's inside anyways. So that's like the first part of the prank. It was, at this point, it wasn't really a prank. It was more just like curiosity more than anything. But then what ended up happening was that we thought it would be a funny thing to just send me more boxes and me just not opening any of them. I had maybe like one or two more extra packages that are coming. But aside from that, I've kind of ended up enlisting the help of other coworkers. They started making these fake packages, like even printing out like real Amazon labels and making it as legit as possible. And the thing is, you can't really do it with empty boxes either. So people were filling it with like so many random things. And we would have this like weird cadence of like, of course, we can't just put everything at the same time like on my desk. So like, I think this went on for like, I swear it was at least a couple of weeks, if not more. And there would be just more and more boxes piling up around me at the office. And the funny part, all my names were on it and they all kind of looked legit. They all had like different weights and they all had different size boxes. And the amount of times that we've kind of like spent trying to hide crafting these boxes and to put them on my desk, because obviously like we were worried that individual would have seen it while we were doing it. It was just so much effort for a very, very dumb prank at the end of the day. It's hard to miss it. So the individual just kept on seeing these boxes and just kept on wondering what's inside of them. And even my original boxes, I don't think I've opened the ones that actually had stuff in it until this whole thing was done. And I think the sad part was that that coworker actually left before this whole prank was done, basically. So I don't know till today they actually know or knew what happened. But still, after all these years, I'm still very, very sorry of that prank happening. And thank you everyone who helped out with the prank. You know who you are. Question number 22. Have you done any wild eating challenges recently? For the record, I don't think I've done any official ones or any ones that are actually like recognized as a food challenge. But I guess I've been known to just go to like bottomless places and just like chow down on a lot of food. And I do enjoy it. I don't do it often. Recently, I did go to this bottomless pancake place. It was more crepes than pancakes. The system was pretty much, you sit down to give you one, and when you're done that one, you just ask them for another one, and then they just keep on giving you another one. plain crepes. There's like your typical maple syrup, which is amazing. Now the question is, how many did I do at the end of the day? Each crepe's about maybe like 6 inches and quite thin, as described by being a crepe. I can't remember, I did like maybe 7? I think at some point you kind of get delusional and you lose track, but as some people know from either experience or watching a lot of food challenges, crepes and pancakes are probably one of the hardest challenges because it fills you up so much, it's quite dense once it soaks up all the maple syrup. I think on record it was 7.5. Don't know why I stopped right before 8. Oh, and it was only like $10, so I would definitely do it again. Question number 23. Who has been your most memorable roommate? Asking because you've had nut jobs. Yeah, good question. I've definitely spoken about a couple of my roommates, maybe like off record or something like that. There's definitely a couple that stood out memorable for the good and the bad. This was in California, actually. It was definitely a flat share situation, and I was sharing this bathroom with this other person who was living there. And I think they were friends with the landlord or something, but I think the context is that this person has been to prison. And don't get me wrong, like, I definitely was not in any danger or anything. They were like a normal individual. But the thing is, sharing a bathroom with them, from the fact that they've been to prison, it was more like they didn't want to see any toiletries anywhere. Or maybe it was a thing in the prison where it's like you're not allowed to see toiletries anywhere in the bathroom. So yeah, there was just this rule of every time you finish using whatever, your toothbrush or cups or whatever, your toothpaste, you just got to put it away every time. And I'm like, okay, on one end, it makes sense if you want to keep everything clean and everything. Like, there were loads of cupboards and put stuff away. That's totally fine. But on the other, I was like, that's hella not practical. Like, you have to do that every time. I never fucked around and found out. Like, I never really went, yo, that's a dumb rule. Like, we're not doing that over here. But it was just stuff like that. Even if they didn't tell me that they went to prison, I think I would have picked that up at some point. Question number 24. Why toilet reviews? Yeah, I've spoken about this a couple of times on the show, but on my Instagram, once in a while, I post these toilet reviews whenever I go to like restaurants or places I haven't been before. And I kind of rate them out of a 5-star system. And I just post it in my stories and I kind of just share it to everyone. And the question is, like, why do I do this? The answer is, I don't know. I really have no idea. But on one end, I think it's just a fun topic of conversation. Like, a lot of people go to restaurants, like, of course, for the food. Like, that's the default. But then if you want, like, a, you know, a overall good experience, you also got to consider, like, the bathroom situation, right? Because I'm assuming that at some point you would eat and, you know, use the washroom to whether wash your hands or do your business or anything like that. So the biggest culprit, I've mentioned it before, is if you go to steakhouses, they genuinely have terrible, terrible washrooms. The cubicles on the bottom part, you can definitely see everything that's happening inside. And the sink doesn't flow well when you turn it on, and like the smell is a bit off. And, you know, there's a lot of these factors that over the years of doing so many toilet reviews, I think I'm reaching maybe 300 reviews now in multiple continents and multiple countries. I think it's pretty much like something that I enjoy sharing. If you do want to find more about that, go onto my Instagram at DrPoor, DocTorPoor, and you'll definitely see more coming over there. Question number 25. What's your opinion on daylight time saving? Well, I've got a boring take on it. I think it's absolutely stupid. It causes way too much technical overhead just because every time I've worked on an app that doesn't handle daylight time saving, it's like a pain and a nightmare to fix it. So don't get me wrong, I know there's a pro where for some people you get to wake up with the sun more. If I could go even more of a rant about daylight time savings, there's a lot of countries who are probably wider than the Americas that have a single time zone for the whole country. I'm not saying that's a good or bad thing, I'm just saying that they've managed to find a way to make it work. And another fun random fact, sorry, I think Arizona has its own time zone specifically. Or maybe parts of Arizona has their own time zone. So I remember when I was working on this like healthcare app, there was a practice right in that area, that zone that has its weird time zone. So when you actually list out like different configuration, you have East Coast, West Coast, Central, and then you have like Arizona. But yeah, at least on the tech side, I think a lot of people would be less panicky if there was not any daylight time saving adjustment happening. Question number 26. Best Halloween snack. Oh, definitely Reese. Hands down, goat of Halloween snacks, Halloween candies. Question number 27. Do you prefer being an older brother or a younger brother? Yeah, that's a good question. Just because I'm both. I'm actually a middle child, so I have an older brother and also a younger brother. And definitely, I think the answer is both. which one do I prefer more? It's situational. It depends on the context. Is if I, this sounds selfish, if I could benefit more from being an older brother in some situation, then I'll do that. If I could benefit more from being a younger brother in some situation, I'll do that. I've rarely looked at situations like that. I think it's just the fact that as a brother, I just enjoy causing trouble, but also helping out when I can't help out. So, you know, when you get Perry as a brother, you get the pros and the cons. Question number 28. Do you still ride motorcycles sometimes? Not really. I'm really upset about this. I wish I was riding a motorcycle more often than I currently am, which is basically like once, if not zero times a year. So after moving from San Francisco to New York, I don't ride anymore. And even when I tell myself like, oh, I have a license, I could totally just rent one and just take like a weekend to go riding, that hasn't really happened. So yeah, the answer is no, not really. But as I was saying, I absolutely enjoy it. There's not a better feeling than just, you know, driving down PCH, going past Half Moon Bay, and then on one side you have like the ocean, and the other side you have like beautiful redwoods, and you got all the smell, and it's like sunny California, and yeah, there's a lot of great reasons to be riding motorcycles, but it's definitely something that I'm going to think about more. Question number 29. Should I start woodworking? Honestly, if your question starts with, should I start, and everything following is not illegal, I would say, yeah, why not? Life is too short to not start doing things. Doesn't matter how old you are. I think like it's very cliche, but woodworking, I think it's really fun because it's very tangible. Like you could touch what you're building as opposed to like the code. You can't really touch it. You just deploy it and it's out in the world and that's pretty much it. So woodworking, yeah, I think it takes a lot of skills. There's like the curve of being a really good woodworker. It's challenging. It's not something that I think you'll complete in like a single day. And you could build all kinds of things in like the domain, I think. It's like it's very vast. Some people could make furniture, but other people could make bowls and utensils out of it. So I think the more I talk about it, the more I personally want to do it as well. But of course, if you relate to that, I guess a curiosity and interest, definitely the answer is yeah, go start woodworking. Question number 30. Favorite Premier League team? I'm guessing it's Manchester United. Okay, leave me alone, you troll. Yeah, it's even weird for me to say, like, I've been following Tottenham Hotspur for a couple of years now. I've been very, very fortunate to have seen a couple games at White Hart Lane and Wembley as well. So yeah, I think it's just torturing myself every season, trying to hope for something and that never happening. That's the life of Tottenham. Shout out to 2008, though. And question number 31. Will Spurs win a trophy this season? Hell yeah. Come on, you Spurs. And that was the last question of this episode 50 AMA Ask Me Anything. Thank you for listening to Podcast Ruined by a Software Engineer. Who knew I would still be doing this after so many dumb hours? Not dumb. I think they're quite insightful, mostly thanks to the amazing guests I've had on the show, and even more exciting, the guests I'm gonna have on the show. So if you're not subscribed already, do hit the follow button on your podcast app so you don't miss out on the new guests. And if you ever do want to reach out to me, I'm available on different social medias. I'm on LinkedIn, Instagram, Twitter. All that info is available at parrotsu.com. And I've seen some of you rock these, but I also do have merch on the website at parrotsu.com/shop. Anyways, I'm Parrotsu, and you've been listening to Podcast Ruined by a Software Engineer. Catch you on the next one. Big love.